You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 1st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ori Shama, staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of Let the Lord Sort Them Out, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. Meanwhile, Joe Biden to meet with 10 Republican senators offering a woefully insufficient COVID relief package. And Donald Trump's legal team quits over the weekend ahead of his upcoming impeachment trial. And as Joe Biden ramps up vaccinations, a new report that the Trump administration actively lobbied lawmakers to deny states vaccine money. 9 of New York State's top health officials have quit over Andrew Cuomo's massive coronavirus failures. Meanwhile, anti-vaxxers shut down one of the country's largest vaccine sites in the country, in California. And as the Republicans solidifies its support of Trump and QAnon followers, they look to purge impeachment supporters. Except, of course, Mitch McConnell, who only supported it privately. Republicans respond to record voter turnout by redoubling their efforts to suppress votes across the country. In Myanmar, military stages a coup claimed to control the country for 1 year as they detain its leader. Popularly elected leader, I should say. Joe Biden reverses the last-minute Donald Trump plan to freeze $27 billion worth of domestic programs. And lastly, Oregon decriminalizes all drugs as of today. Addicts to be offered treatment as opposed to prison. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is thanks for joining us at the beginning of the week. And of course, having trudged through the snow, Emma Viglin is with us. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. The snow and wind. You left that part out. The whipping winds is what gets me. I love the snow, but when I can't feel my face because of the wind. That's the tough part. Yeah.
The snow and the wind. Yes. Well, yes. Apologies. We're getting hit pretty hard with a snowstorm. Well, the entire East Coast, I think, is so, or at least the Northeast Coast, expecting, I don't know, maybe a foot at the end of all of this. But kids aren't as excited as they usually are because there's no real snow days or sort of not as exciting when you're.
Yeah, they're home all the time now. Yeah,
exactly.
They wish they had a snow day where they could go in, be away from dad for a second. Yeah.
Yes. Well, they're away from dad. But all that said, thanks for joining us, folks. Obviously, a busy week. We've got we have the Republicans. I think I think it was last week, last Thursday, we were talking about the COVID relief bill. And one of the dynamics that was coming out was this gang of 16 that so-called moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats had convened as a way of essentially undercutting the $1.9 trillion package that Joe Biden had proposed for COVID relief. And one of the problems with that is that Gang of 16, 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans. 8 Republicans doesn't get you anything, because 8 Republicans is the same as no Republicans on a bill, because if you don't hit at least 10 Republicans, then you cannot defeat their filibuster. And because you need at least 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. Well, somebody on the Republican side figured that out, and they said, we've got to even appear like we're doing anything real, we've got to present 10 Republicans who can sign on to a bill. The problem is the Republican Party has moved so far to the right and has so little interest in helping Americans recover from COVID, the economic effects, and frankly, I mean, this new report out about Donald Trump's administration lobbying quite successfully, it appears, Republican lawmakers to deny states funding for vaccinations, that Republicans had no interest in helping Americans recover from the economic impact of the COVID pandemic, nor apparently the actual pandemic itself. And so they presented a $600 billion bill, which is not even remotely close to the task. And so Democrats are faced with two questions here, or two options. One is to stop trying to pursue a deal with Republicans for the sake of pursuing a deal with Republicans, and simply take all of this and just do it through reconciliation, or to maybe strike a deal for $600 billion with Republicans there and then hope that you can go into reconciliation and make up the rest. However, we know there are shaky Democrats here. We'll talk more about that later in the program. We're talking about like folks like Kristen Sinema. We're talking about folks like Joe Manchin. John Tester, Emma, you said you saw it came out in support of saying that $1.9 billion was not too much money.
Trillion, yeah, yes. Yeah, right. And so that's, to me, that's a good indicator that Schumer will be able to keep his caucus together eventually. But I think the problem here is that they are wasting way too much time, Biden and co., in order to give the appearance of bipartisanship, as if the American public cares whether their stimulus checks are passed through reconciliation or over a filibuster. I mean, it just seems like very odd doing this bizarre dance that's entirely unnecessary.
Right. And is it really bipartisanship anyways? Like, what does that really mean in this instance, that you get 10, a quarter of the Republican caucus? No, excuse me, less than a quarter, 20% of the Republican caucus to sign on 1/3 of what is actually needed for the American public. Here is Bernie Sanders responding to Martha Raddatz on ABC This Week from this weekend about the idea of passing through reconciliation. And understand, reconciliation simply means that you need a majority vote, period. It's not that radical of a concept in what is supposedly a democracy. Here's number one.
Good morning, Senator. The Democrats seem prepared to pass Biden's COVID relief package with or without Republican support, which has been shrinking in recent days. Did the president overestimate the appetite for bipartisanship?
Look, Martha, we all want bipartisanship, and I think you're going to see more of it as we move down the pike. You're going to see bipartisanship on infrastructure. There are a lot of Republicans who are outraged by the high cost of prescription drugs in this country. We pay 10 times more than other countries do for certain drugs. We are going to look forward to working with Republicans. But right now, this country faces an unprecedented set of crises. We have families who are watching this program right now who cannot feed their kids. We have millions of people who face eviction. We are in the midst of the worst pandemic in 100 years. We have got to act, and we have got to act now.
And you,
and we just don't have.
Senator, you said you can't reach out to Republicans indefinitely and Democrats should use the majority. But this morning we're hearing 10 GOP senators have a new plan. So is it a mistake for Democrats to consider abandoning bipartisanship negotiations so soon?
Martha, the issue is not, you know, bipartisanship. We're not. The issue is, are we going to address the incredible set of crises and the pain and the anxiety which is in this country? You know what? I don't care what anybody says. We have got to deal with this pandemic. We have got to make sure that we are producing the vaccines that we need and get those vaccines into the arms of people. We cannot have children in America going hungry, people being evicted, schools not open. We need to open our schools in a safe way. That's what we have to do. So the question is not bipartisanship. The question is addressing the unprecedented crises that we face right now. If Republicans want to work with us, they have better ideas on how to address those crises. That's great. But to be honest with you, I have not yet heard that.
Does your party have the votes to pass the relief package through the reconciliation process if you decide to go that route?
Yeah, I believe that we do, because it's hard for me to imagine any Democrat, no matter what state he or she may come from, who doesn't understand the need to go forward right now in an aggressive way to protect the working families of this country. Look, all of us will have differences of opinion. This is a $1.9 trillion bill. I have differences and concerns about this bill. But at the end of the day, we're going to support the President of the United States, and we're going to come forward, and we're going to do what the American people overwhelmingly want us to do.
Well, I just love how he frames that. I mean, the issue with all of this is that Joe Biden has framed this bipartisanship being necessary as a precursor to passing this bill. Now, he's backed off of it a little, but this was what he ran on. Bernie's framing is exactly correct. I mean, the media likes bipartisanship for bipartisanship's sake, and that's one of my frustrations with it. That's where the framing of those questions comes in, where it's just about, can you come to a compromise? Well, what does that compromise entail? And I love how Sanders is able to reframe it from, no, let's talk about the substance of the relief, as opposed to the salsa dance or the tango of bipartisanship. That's the better analogy than the salsa.
I have to say that when I was watching that clip, the idea of having Bernie Sanders as the chairman of the budget committee really does make this very this pivot much easier to make when there was a certain inevitability. And look, Joe Biden ran on unity, and I think we will see, hopefully, knock on wood, that he is going to define unity as something other than having to compromise Sanders says that I think he was implying he would like a bigger bill, frankly, and I think there are others who would. Certainly, I would be one of those. But at the very least, we're not seeing Joe Biden do what the Obama administration did, which is come out, compromise with themselves as a way of enticing Republicans, spend a lot of time with Republicans basically taking a step back from meeting in the middle, then taking a step forward to meet Republicans in the new middle, and have that dance go on for a year and a half. Instead, what we're seeing is the Biden administration not only holding fast. They are, you know, they're inviting the Republicans to the White House, and we will see what comes out of this. But if it's just like, hey, I invited them, we talked, we couldn't come to an agreement, we're just going to pass this because we have the majority. That is a great way to define unity. Unity meaning, well, I'm willing to meet with them, have lunch, and if we can't come to an agreement, we're going to go forward with this. But one of the things, and we'll expand on this later in the program. They sent Kamala Harris out to do interviews in Arizona and West Virginia. It ruffled Joe Manchin's feathers a little bit, basically reiterating the point, we need this bill. And so if there was any shakiness that Joe Manchin was feeling or Kristen Sinema, this was a way to put pressure on them. And Joe Manchin bucked a little bit. But we then had the Republican governor of West Virginia come out and say, we need this. And so this is so far, I would like to see a bigger number, but so far, at least with the number that the Biden administration, and I think one that, look, Joe Biden won the primary, won the presidency. They're at least holding to what they said that they would do. Although I think, you know, there's a very good argument that if you're going into reconciliation, you might as well make those checks $2,000 just for the, A, we know the benefit that it provides people. B, we also know the politics of this. But we should take a break now. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Marie Sciama, staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of Let the Lord Sort Them Out, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. In the meantime, a couple of sponsors of today's program. Reminder, your support makes this show possible. If you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you get the free half of the show, free of commercials as well. It's another little bonus. With that said, I know folks are busy. Everybody wants to get a little smarter and a little bit better read. Am I right, Emma?
Yeah, sorry. I didn't. I had accidentally muted myself. yes, I do.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. Well
Emma, I mean, my brain clearly needs to be sharpened because I forgot I was on mute.
Now, do you want to sit through an entire book that's going to tell you like 10 lessons on how to sharpen your brain? No, you don't need all the prose there and the poetry and no, you want to get what they call the key takeaways. Well, the way you do that by using an app called Blinkist. Blinkist takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in 27 different categories, gathers them together in 15-minute text or audio explainers, basically like cliff notes, but they call them blinks. Does anybody remember cliff notes, or is that just me? Monarch?
No, I do. I remember it being very... taboo, like, it's right.
Well, but, you know, if you've got a nice piece of literature, you want to read the literature because it's good.
Well, I was thinking of it in the context of like homework. It was very taboo to use cliff notes, but Blinks, now that you're an adult, you get to use cliff notes,
exactly.
Except this Blinks.
And so Blinks let you get to a topic quickly, finds new topics that you want to grow from or figure out which books you want to spend time reading or listening to more deeply. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to create Blinks for those too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. Apparently 15 million people already use Blinkist. And for me, like I say, I've mentioned this in the past, you know, people say I've got a little personality issues or I'm not that friendly. And we'll dig into some of these, like how to, you know, make friends or how to, you know, be appropriate or, you know, be sincere or stuff like that. But I'm not going to read the whole book. So I do it. I do it quickly. And then the other thing I do for Blinkist is books that I feel like I should know about and should read, but I don't really want to. But I can pretend like I did, you know, and like, I guess we don't have many cocktail parties anymore and I don't really get invited to them. But in the event that maybe I bump into somebody, but that is.
Put it on your dating profile. App,
exactly.
Right? Like how well read you are. You've read all these books.
Definitely. On the dating profile, you definitely want to be able to say that you read Blowout by Rachel Maddow. And I did the Blink. You know, that's and then, of course, there's also stuff like, you know, the investing stuff. I feel like I should know about it, but I'm not very good at that. So Barefoot Investor by Scott Pape. You blink that right now. Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. Start your free 7-day trial. Get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled BLINKIST. Blinkist.com/majority report. You get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. Also, folks, nobody wants to leave their house to go shopping these days. I am not a particular good dresser or chooser of clothes. And I have one solution that deals with both those problems. Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix offers clothing that is hand selected by expert stylists for your unique style, your size, your style, your budget, whatever it is. It's the super easy solution to finding what makes you look and feel your best. This is what happens. They suggest 4 or 5 pieces of clothing to you. You try the pieces on home before you buy. You keep your favorites. If you don't like any of them, you send them back. You pay $20 styling fee for each box, which, of course, you can edit before they send it to you. And then it gets credited towards any piece that you keep. There's no subscription required. You can try Stitch Fix once, or you can set up automatic deliveries. Shipping, returns, exchanges, they're easy, super free, or I should say free and super easy. And they give you a prepaid envelope in each box, so it makes it super easy. And they have styles for women. They have styles for men. They have styles for kids. They ship all over the U.S. and in the U.K. For me, I've talked about the straight pocket, 5-pocket. This is a huge revelation for me. Because for a long time, I was just wearing Carhartts with like 8 pockets. And
so you simplified the pocket experience?
I just returned to sort of like the jean style, which I hadn't worn in years. And I got this great pair of pants, sort of like, I only have like a 3-color palette that I use for anything. Right. I think people can know that. But sort of like a dark green Nashville 5-pocket thing. And then I got a flannel shirt, which Mila took care of. She, of course, absconded with that immediately. And I got a thermal shirt that I wasn't sure about. But now, one of those waffle ones that I used to wear back in my slacker days.
Oh, and those are just the most comfortable things in the world. Anything waffle, I'm down to purchase.
I got
to
say,
food and clothing.
I now just wear one shirt over the weekend. That's usually it. Which I should probably do something about that. But right now you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's everything in your box at stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And lastly, we're also sponsored today by Third Love. Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort and support. Every Third Love bra is made with signature memory foam cups, no slip straps, scratch-free band in a variety of sizes. They have this online fit finder quiz, which, based upon our two Third Love official testers, I am not one of them.
I am one. I have multiple Third Love bras, and I do multiple. Even before I started working here, and I think they are just like the best. I wouldn't force you to wear them.
Well, my understanding, the big deal that people tell me is that they fit, which is apparently very, very difficult to find online. And they have a Third Love Perfect Promise fit or fit promise, where if you don't love it, you can exchange it. Returns are super easy. They're free for 60 days. 2021 is your time to shine, folks. Focus on what makes you happy, starting with better bras and better underwear. You can check out all the exclusive styles at thirdlove.com, from modern stripes to lace that actually feels soft to their number one rated 24/7 classic t-shirt bra. Here is one of our testimonials from one of our two Third Love trier outers. The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in, but in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online. Certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of style is amazing. Both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit. They are incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering my listeners 20% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority. Right now, to find your perfect fitting bra, get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off today. Check it out, folks. We will put all the links into the podcast description and at majority.fm and on our YouTube page and in the podcast description. Okay. I want to welcome to the program Maurice Chama. He is a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of Let the Lord Sort Them Out, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. Or I should say, Let the Lord Sort Them. Maurice, welcome to the program. Oh, we can't hear you.
Oh,
there you go. Now we can.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Great.
Maurice, welcome to the program. Congratulations on your book. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Sorry for the technical chaos.
that is the era we are living in. So, all right, Maurice, let's start with this. I did not know this. I mean, I've been, you know, I guess I should say I am an opponent of the death penalty and have been for, I think, most of my adult life. I was not aware of how close we were to ending the death penalty in 1972. Will you tell us about that?
Sure. This shocked me, too, when I got into the research. I mean, in the 1960s, the death penalty virtually disappeared in the United States. This was back when Europe was abandoning it, Canada abolished it, and it seemed like we were going to do it, too. There were just like no executions year by year, and that was largely because a group of civil rights lawyers had managed to convince the courts to stop executions and sort of slow them down by just filing every motion they could think of. In 1972, the Supreme Court then took on a case that these civil rights lawyers brought to them that was about whether the death penalty violates the Constitution. And the Supreme Court said it does violate the Constitution, but just the laws that we have, not the death penalty itself. The death penalty is fine in and of itself, but the laws that different states have on the books for how it gets doled out are problematic, right? And so what this ends up doing is inviting the states, largely southern states, largely states that where sort of states' rights are a big part of the picture, and there's a general sort of consensus against Washington and, you know, federal edicts. These states write new death penalty laws, and we see the sort of backlash play out in those laws, and then, you know, executions start to come back in the 1980s and 90s.
All right. So, I mean, let's be explicit. I want to be a little more explicit about that 1972 Furman versus Georgia case, because sure. When it said the death penalty, it didn't say, they didn't decide that the death penalty was unconstitutional. What they said was that the specifics in the way that it was being doled out was That's unconstitutional.
Right. That's right.
So it's more like sort of like, it's not so much that the death penalty is bad, just to simplify, but rather the way that you're going about it is bad.
That's right. And that there, you know, these civil rights lawyers had argued to the court that it's racially biased, right? That whether you get the death penalty has much more to do with your race than it does with the particular crime that you committed. The justices aren't willing to go that far. They're very sort of uncomfortable talking about race. So they focus mainly on it being arbitrary, right? That two different people can commit the same crime, and whether it's race or some other set of factors, there's sort of a totally random outcome on which one of those two people actually gets the death penalty and gets executed. One judge, justice on the Supreme Court, compared it to being struck by lightning, right? And so when the states go back and try to write these new laws, they're mainly trying to solve that problem, to try to create some, you know, meaningful distinction between who gets the death penalty and who doesn't.
All right, let's take a, I want to just take a slight detour mm-hmm. before we go back on how this was addressed and talk a little bit about Texas, because in many respects, the story of the death penalty is a story of Texas in many respects. And we should just say, in terms of the statistics about who gets the death penalty, I think at this point you've shown that, or at least you cite a study that showed it is the race of the person who is killed, which often determines the probability you will get the death penalty, not so much the race of the person who commits the murder, but the race of the person who is killed. Well, let's talk about the about Texas and this concept of, I mean, I think certainly, I don't know if I've ever really thought about it that strongly, but I think I would have perceived that the idea of Texas being sort of the number one place for the death penalty in this country, certainly as of late, was a function of the number one in terms of biggest percentage mm-hmm. of any one state, I should say. Mm-hmm. One third of our death penalties, right, our executions have taken place there out of 1,500. I think it's about 500, more or less. That it would have been like, this is all about frontier justice. But you tell this, you tell it a couple of different ways through Craig Washington, who is a lawmaker and Demelyn Reiser. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her name.
Demelyn Reiser, sure.
Demelyn Reiser. Yeah, tell us about those two and about what the story they tell about the death penalty.
Right. So in the 1970s, Texas legislators were debating sort of whether to bring the death penalty back and how to bring it back. And most of the legislators, sort of in these old recordings I found, talked about Texas's, you know, long history of frontier justice, this idea that if the state doesn't execute people, you know, groups of vigilantes are just going to go string people up. And there's a lot of references to, you know, barroom fights and the just sort of predilection for violence among Texans. Found a lot of data to back that up. Violent crime was not, you know, higher here than it was anywhere else. But there was a sort of image of like John Wayne movies that you would see in the political conversation back then. And you still see it today in certain instances. I certainly heard it when I was researching for the book. But there's sort of another narrative out there. And this is the narrative of lynchings, right? Texas, like many other southern states, had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of illegal mob killings, essentially, of primarily black men in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And there's a handful of lawyers in Texas who have really done a lot of the work to try to raise that story up and connect the dots between those illegal lynchings and the sort of legal executions that followed. You know, many listeners might be familiar with Bryan Stevenson in Alabama, who's a sort of famous figure in terms of making this argument. But in Texas, Craig Washington, who was a member of the legislature in the 70s, and then Demelyn Reiser, who's a defense lawyer who is still active and working, were both sort of very leading figures in trying to, from a scholarly perspective and then from a kind of political perspective, connect the dots and explain how, you know, sure, lynchings were illegal and executions are legal, but the line between them can get very fuzzy. One story that was really compelling to me in the book is that there was a man named Dick Garrett who was executed in the first decade of the 20th century, and he was put on trial, and it was a legal trial. Technically, his constitutional rights were not violated. It was a four-hour-long trial over whether he was going to get the death penalty for committing murder. And while he was in the courtroom, he could hear the sound of saws and hammers outside because they were already building the scaffold, because the sort of outcome of this trial was a sort of foregone conclusion. And that was an example that Reiser brought up in her own writing and that I point to as evidence of how thin that line can be between the lynchings, you know, that we think of as the past and the executions that the state came to carry out throughout the 20th century.
I there's a couple of things I just want to, I want to dig in a little bit more on the, that these lynchings of course took place sort of like as a way of ending Reconstruction, mm-hmm. and bringing in this new era of really of blowback or pushback or of new white supremacy that, you know, we have talked about on this program quite a bit, the rise of the KKK in that era and starting to put up all the statues of Southern, you know, generals and Confederate war heroes, as it were. But this idea that the state lawmakers in Texas were justifying executions as a way of preempting lynchings. Can you talk about that a little bit more in that the fuzziness? I mean, I can see the sort of the metaphor there with you can hear them building the gallows before the verdict comes. Like this is a foregone conclusion. We're just now adding in a layer of sort of respectability to this lynching. What other elements of this, center around it? Is it race? Is it the way that they publicize and demonize? What are the other elements that sort of satiate, I guess? What is being satiated?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I mean, and I should say, it's not just Texas legislators. There were members of the Supreme Court who also said, if we don't have the death penalty, we're going to risk having, you know, illegal vigilante justice and mob killings of people. And again, there was sort of no real evidence to back that up. But it's the argument that these, you know, members of the Supreme Court made. I think that in Texas, there's been a sort of particular cultural story about what's getting satiated in terms of justice that gets told that kind of clouds the picture. And so, you know, while lynchings in Alabama and Georgia and Florida were primarily associated with race historically, in Texas, they also primarily fell upon, you know, black men, and often after accusations of, you know, having sex with a white woman. It's a very common thing that would happen in Texas just as much as the other southern states. But when Texans talk about lynching, they have a different image in mind. They have a kind of, like I said before, John Wayne movie of, you know, stringing up the cattle rustler, right? The sort of white cowboys going after the guy. And if, yes, it's dirty. Yes, it's unfortunate. It's kind of a regrettable necessity of the frontier. There was a famous television ad in the 90s for Pace Salsa where they find out they're eating, these cowboys find out they're eating salsa that was made in New York. And they look at the chef and they say, get a rope. And there's just this very flip attitude towards lynchings. Born of the idea that they're a kind of nostalgic relic of the frontier rather than a tool of, you know, maintaining a racial caste order in the wake of the Civil War, which we, and in the founding of Texas, which we, you know, as historians and scholars and journalists know that's the history. But there's this kind of cultural story that it's really just about punishing, you know, white cowboys, right? That gets told that I think, you know, allows race to get subsumed. And then over the course of the 80s and 90s, you know, I read dozens of trial transcripts and you see that race gets subsumed even further. So you, they never say, you know, that black man is going to go and if we don't execute him, he's going to go and rape and kill more people. They say, you know, these monsters roaming the streets, we can't, we're not safe in our beds at night because those people are running around, you know, killing innocent Americans. And they don't say race, they don't say black people, but you can start to read it between the lines. And it's the same era in which, you know, crime and a fear of crime becomes a kind of coded way of talking about race in politics, right? Under Nixon and Reagan. So this is just a part of the bigger story.
Yeah. And Maurice, just connecting it back to Texas as well, because I think it being so central to what you wrote about is just key. You know, how Rick Perry and other politicians coming out of Texas use the carrying out of executions and like record breaking. I mean, I remember Rick Perry on the debate stage bragging about how many people he would execute. And I know you wrote about that as well, how he broke records. How that's still so integral to the politics of that state now, and how it's like hard for some northern people like myself to understand, but how all of that history culminates in the politics of the state even today.
It's true. And there's a great anthropologist who wrote like a PhD dissertation that I read in which she interviewed all these people who had served on juries in Texas and sentenced people to death. And they never say they themselves have these cultural ideas, but they say, oh yeah, where I'm from in whatever town, you know, people just want to string them up. Like there's a, this sort of idea that we all believe this as Texans. I found in the research, a lot of her just cultural references that go beyond the debate stage, you know, the comedian Ron White making flip jokes about executions or, you know, on SNL or The Simpsons. It's this idea that Texas is the epicenter of the death penalty and executions, and that it comes from this old cowboy culture. I think there have been moments where, you know, running for president George W. Bush or Rick Perry have confronted some questions and, you know, sort of antagonism from people, you know, for whom the death penalty is a relic, people, you know, confronting them on the debate stage in other states, in Iowa or New York. But in Texas, it's a selling point still politically and culturally. I do think that's starting to change. I mean, a lot of our bigger cities, not just Austin, but Houston and Dallas, have become more diverse. You have district attorneys running for office in these counties that are saying, you know, we're not going to seek the death penalty as often anymore. And they have, again, more diverse and sort of Democratic leaning voter bases in those big cities. So I do think you're seeing things start to turn the corner in line with the larger kind of cultural shift in Texas that, again, I'm not one of those people who think Texas is going to turn blue tomorrow, but you can see the signs of change.
I don't want to get too hung up on the Texas thing, but I'm really fascinated by this. And I'm fascinated by the sort of the myths that we have, not just this, but, you know, things like the Lost Cause and whatnot that we build to hide sort of the underlying realities. And I, you know, I grew up on a lot of Westerns as a kid. And I keep thinking about Hang 'Em High, which is that Clint Eastwood movie about hanging. And so much of it was about, we can't get the guy back to, we're too far away. to the central, the one jail that we have. So we're going to have to hang him here because I'm not going to be able to bring this guy back alive. And that whole notion of, like, you know, overtaxed and not overtaxed, but overmatched law, you know, lawmen, and, you know, their inability to bring people to justice, and they got to do it right there because otherwise this guy's going to go free. I mean, that whole sort of mythos in some respect feels like it was developed, you know, you had this massive expanse of space. And so you could develop this myth on some level, but it really probably was just covering up for a certain amount of viciousness. And then ultimately sort of to hide this sort of racial component of the story.
Yeah. Another example I often bring up for people is the Alamo, which is like the sort of foundational myth of Texas that many Americans have heard about. And we, you know, growing up in Texas, hear the story about the sort of celebratory, you know, that they lost at the Alamo, but then they got victory, you know, not long after that. But many of these sort of foundational figures in Texas history held these same very pernicious views of race and slavery. They were very afraid of, you know, freed slaves taking over Texas. And they developed these myths to try to kind of cloud the picture for people and give them not necessarily a bloodlust support for the death penalty, but this idea that you're describing, it's almost like with a sigh, oh, it's a regrettable necessity. It's too bad we have to have it, but we're too far from the courthouse and the jail, so let's just do it. And of course, that's couldn't be further from the truth today, but these ideas still circulate with a fair amount of nostalgia.
And we should also mention, we mentioned Rick Perry, but Bill Clinton, sort of to project, and we could probably talk for hours on what the theory was amongst his campaign, you know, because he was dealing with the idea that he was a draft dodger and this and that, needed to project some measure of strength, I guess. But he ordered the execution of Ricky Rector, I think his name was, who was an African-American man who I can't remember the specifics, but had a particularly low IQ. Tell us just more about that story, and how that plays into this.
Sure, absolutely. So I think the political context that's worth noting there is that the death penalty became a kind of culture war issue and a political touchstone in the 80s and 90s. Many people remember the Willie Horton ad where Dukakis, you know, was accused of letting a man out to rape and kill. But Dukakis also faced questions on the debate stage about what would happen if his wife was raped and murdered. Would he support the death penalty? And the fact that he seemed weak on that issue to voters was really unhelpful for him. And so, you know, 4 years later, Bill Clinton is running for president. He gets a lot of accusations that he's liberal and wishy-washy and needs to project an image of toughness. And he flies home from the campaign trail to preside over an execution of this man, Ricky Rector. Ricky Rector was African-American, and he had actually suffered brain damage, I think, from a bullet that hit him in the head when he killed a police officer. And so he was psychologically, you know, very diminished and did not really understand what his execution was about. The famous anecdote that I find very chilling from that is that he had a last meal, and at the end of the last meal was a piece of pie. And he said, I'm going to store that and put it in the fridge and eat it later. And didn't really understand that it was his own last meal. And Bill Clinton got a lot of flack for that on the left. And I've even seen people on the right who support the death penalty, you know, bring that up as an example of his particular callousness. I think a lot of political leaders today regret how they use the death penalty in ways that look very callous to our modern eyes. I mean, one of them is President Biden, right? In the Senate in the early 90s, he was touting a bill and he said, you know, in this bill, it's great. We do everything but hang people for jaywalking. And again, with the word hang, kind of evokes this sort of old mythology. Now Biden says that he opposes the death penalty, but he's sort of not alone. There's been a whole sea change, I think, in the Democratic Party where they've come to see that the punishment is problematic. And there's a question of sort of going forward, how much of a priority they make it and how much they try to bring the right along.
Well, there's like this, you know, after effect from all of the law and order push by the Republican Party, Nixon, Reagan, like that was so central to those campaigns. And then you talk about the after effects in the 90s of Timothy McVeigh and how that kind of allowed for the public to stomach the notion of a death penalty. But what's so saddening about that is obviously he was an outlier, a massive outlier, because a lot of this affects poorer people and traditionally black people as well. So can you talk about that moment as how it punctuated this conversation or pushed it forward?
Absolutely. So in the early 90s, there was a series of bills in which we vastly expanded the federal death penalty. Again, Biden and a lot of Democrats were involved with this. And there was a tension politically, or not politically, I should say, just sort of practically speaking, where they wanted executions to happen faster and more regularly, and they wanted to shorten appeals, but they also didn't want people on death row to be, you know, deprived of lawyers, with the risk of someone's potentially innocent being executed, or, you know, with their constitutional rights sort of grossly violated. Biden was involved in trying to, he was a former public defender himself, and he was trying to navigate that very narrow path. And the political conversation was kind of going along behind the scenes. Democrats and Republicans disagreed, but they were sort of hashing out these different bills. And then the Oklahoma City bombing happened, and that really transformed the debate, because it seemed like any effort to give more constitutional rights to death row prisoners would be helping someone like Timothy McVeigh. That wasn't really true, because Timothy McVeigh sort of uniquely actually gave up his appeals and said, I don't want to fight my execution. I just want to be executed. And that's part of why he was executed only a few years later. But that political, you know, transformation meant that Congress pushed through a bill in 1996 called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And it had very little to do with terrorism, and it primarily reduced the ability of people on death row to file appeals. There was this idea that they were, you know, stringing their cases along for decades as they just raised one unimportant issue after another and forced all the judges and courts to visit them. That was a bit of a myth. I mean, there were real constitutional issues in these cases, but in the wake of that bill, which is not very famous, but I think very important, not just for the death penalty, but the whole criminal justice system, it just became a lot harder if you were in prison to get a court to listen to your new evidence that you were innocent, or that, you know, you had brain damage and shouldn't be executed for that reason, right? It really hampered the ability of prisoners to get their claims heard in court.
Just the way that Emma phrased that question, where an outlier became the story that provided cover to maintain the sort of racially biased system is analogous to, you know, what we saw with the entire outgrowth of the of so-called capital punishment. All right. So going back to the response from that 1972 case, Texas reshapes the way that they're going to operationalize the capital punishment. They write a statute, essentially says that there needs to be three, the jury needs to answer three questions. Was the killing unprovoked? Was it deliberate? And does this person represent a continuing threat to society, more or less? And you write that the authors of this bill ultimately were like a little bit unsure that they had really cracked the code, as it were. So the capital punishment comes sort of roaring back. The Supreme Court revisits the question in a case versus Texas in 1976, Jerk v. Texas. Mm-hmm. And then so basically, what do they decide at that point?
So in 1976, Texas is one of a bunch of states that have brought back the death penalty, and every state has written a somewhat different law. And the Supreme Court has to decide, you know, are we going to bless all of these laws, or none of them, or just some of them? And they decide that the most harsh law, the harshest laws, which came out of North Carolina and Louisiana, which effectively made the death penalty mandatory for certain kinds of crimes. You know, you kill a police officer, there's no, you know, question. You just go straight to death row if you're found guilty. They decided that that was too harsh, and that the juries should be allowed to actually look at the sort of individual life circumstances of the person they're sentencing. They should be able to look at whether they feel remorse, or whether they had were abused as a child, sort of all the things that we now hear about in death penalty cases. So North Carolina, Louisiana said, None of that. The Supreme Court said, yes, you have to have that. And so they strike down those very harsh laws. The Texas law isn't technically mandatory, but it also really limits the ability of juries to hear that kind of information, because those three questions are very simple. And even to this day, you will hear prosecutors say to members of a jury, you don't have to decide whether or not this man is going to live or die. You just have to answer these three questions. And so it allows them to kind of offload responsibility. And the scholars who have kind of looked at this future dangerousness question have found that, you know, asking juries to predict whether somebody's going to commit crimes in the future and making the death sentence based on that question, on the one hand, it can't be done. There's really no meaningful way to predict the future. But second of all, it opens the door to a lot of fear-based arguments from prosecutors. It also allows them to kind of spin, you know, negatives into positives. Or, you know, they can, so for example, you know, this person is seriously mentally ill. And where in Florida or some of these other states, the defense lawyers can bring the evidence of mental illness to say, this is a reason to spare this person's life. In Texas, when it's used to answer that question, it just becomes, oh, they're seriously mentally ill, so they can't have remorse and, you know, they are going to definitely kill someone again, right? And it gives prosecutors this tool to kind of speed these cases along towards execution. So it's a very wonky story, but I wanted to tell it because I think it's a really crucial thing to understand about why Texas became the epicenter from a legal perspective.
So we have the death penalty come roaring back to the point where a presidential candidate in 93, I guess 92, flies off the campaign to make a real show of this. I mean, this is, you know, I don't want to be glib about it, but it was like how can I top that sister soldier moment on some level for Bill Clinton? And, but then what happens from like 94 to, let's say, 2019? And I date that before, you know, Donald Trump, you know, had the opportunity to sort of execute his plan to up executions. 11, I think it was, since July, federal executions. But what, like, how did the death penalty, like, how did the fall come?
So I think the peak is a little later. You know, you have Clinton flying home, but executions really peak around 99, 2000. And this is when George W. Bush is running for president. And the fact that he has overseen the biggest, you know, death penalty system in the country is a major feature of that electoral campaign. It wasn't the center of it because it's not like Gore was out there opposing executions. But there were a handful of big scandalous cases that made Bush look sort of bad to the left and lended a kind of circus atmosphere to the Texas death penalty in those days. There was the case of Gary Graham, where he was a black man who was potentially innocent, and the Black Panther Party and the Ku Klux Klan were out there in the streets in Huntsville outside the execution chamber protesting. CNN was covering it. There were these big dramatic cases that I think really forced Americans to look at these questions of, are we getting it right? Is someone innocent getting, you know, potentially going to be executed? And then there was the case of Carla Faye Tucker, a woman who had a very dramatic conversion to Christianity on death row and seemed very redeemed. And I think that led a lot of evangelicals to question capital punishment. So you have these big cases and something kind of breaks in those years. George Bush is, of course, elected shortly after that. 9/11. One argument I've heard is that 9/11 kind of shifts the sort of orientation of fear for Americans away from violent criminals who commit murder and to, you know, terrorism cases and, you know, the 9/11 hijackers. And so there's less of a sort of obsession with carrying out lots of death sentences and executions politically, because who the sort of enemy is has changed. And then in the midst of all that, quietly, you have defense lawyers who are getting better at just case by case convincing juries to spare the lives of people, even those who have committed really terrible crimes. I mean, there's a dramatic Houston case from 2008 in which a man who was undocumented, who had been charged with sexual assault in the past, who had been deported and come back to the United States, is here in the country without documentation and kills a police officer. And this would have been the kind of textbook case for the death penalty in Texas. And his lawyer, Daniel Inreiser, whose story I tell in the book, manages to convince a jury to spare this man's life by doing just a lot of research on his life and finding the sort of stories and the way of understanding him that doesn't excuse the crime or the murder of a police officer, but just gives them enough information to say this man's life is worth sparing. And in case after case that happens, and so year by year, the number of new death sentences goes into decline. Prosecutors start to realize how expensive these cases are, and they can't afford to seek death sentences at a certain point. And politically, it just becomes a little less charged. All of these things sort of combine and gel, and the number of new death sentences and executions starts to tick down year by year. And I should say that Trump, of course, oversaw 13 executions, more than any president in decades. But the number of new death sentences and even the number of executions, even with those Trump executions, has been still in decline. And once Trump is no longer carrying them out, I think we're going to see over the next few years very, very low numbers.
So this is a story of, in terms of the diminishment of this in practice, right, is this sort of, symbiotic relationship between, like, the Innocence Project showing that there, you know, it's flaw, that convictions can be flawed, and lawyers, arguing to juries why you should spare someone's life, and the juries coming from society and have gotten this message that the death penalty can be flawed, that crime, in addition to terrorism, maybe supplanting the big fear for Americans, is also at a record sort of decline in crime that is taking place across the country. I don't want to get into my whole lead theory and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's happening across the country, regardless really of what police departments are doing in any given place. And so the experience of crime that your average American has goes down significantly over this time. So all these things begin to feed into each other, and there's sort of like a virtuous, I would consider it, circle of a feedback loop. So how do we get, this is a story in many respects of something that's incremental in many respects, but where do we take this next big leap to, and I guess the moratorium that was placed under Obama for the federal executions, was that under Obama?
He had a sort of unofficial moratorium, and now we're waiting to see whether Biden also has one, right?
And so what is the next, is there anything that can take us to that next level where it's like, we've shut the door on it? I mean, is it statutory, a federal statute? Could that control what states do, or?
It couldn't control what states do. So even if, and there is a bill in Congress now to abolish the federal death penalty. I don't know. I can't, handicap its chances of success. But even if that were to pass, that would not do away with the death penalty, because Texas, a lot of other states, Florida, Missouri, would still keep carrying them out. And those states, at least politically, seem extremely unlikely to stop executing, right, and stop carrying out death sentences. Biden could do certain complex things around federal incentives that sort of incentivize states to not carry out executions, whether that's guaranteeing them better lawyers, more funding. But it's really an incremental story. And I think that series of next steps that take us from a very diminished death penalty to no death penalty at all are going to be a lot of time and effort, and it might take a very long time. But that said, I think that there's sort of a bigger lesson in all of this, which is that a lot of the arguments about whether someone's capable of redemption or mercy, are not uniquely connected to the death penalty. These questions also, circle around cases where we consider whether to send someone to prison for the rest of their life, right, without the possibility of parole at all, right, 60 years, a virtual life sentence. We still give them to people who are, 18, 19 years old. And I think that a cultural debate will shift, even if there are still executions, that kind of cultural conversation about justice and mercy and redemption for people who commit very serious crimes might shift away from just talking about the death penalty and more to these cases of essentially just throwing someone in prison for the rest of their lives.
So it'll be more of a question of carceral reform.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part of the point of the book for me and the research was to say that, we think of the death penalty in isolation, but it's connected to the whole justice system. It's sort of the symbolic pinnacle of a very punitive justice system. and you take the death penalty away or mostly take it away, and that then becomes a debate about sort of the next harshest punishments.
And the Supreme Court is completely impossible at this point. Was there any period of time over the past like 30 years where there was a court that might have been amenable to saying, you know what, we you know, now that we've evolved as a society, we realize like the state should not have the ability to premeditatedly kill someone?
Oh, absolutely. I think there was a chance the Supreme Court might have done that even 4 years ago. You know, there was a conversation at the time going on among defense lawyers about, you know, can we bring a big dramatic case to the court in which they strike down the death penalty once and for all? Some, you know, cynics said that's a fool's errand. It's not going to happen. But it really all came down to whether Anthony Kennedy might, having, you know, over the course of many years, sort of shown his that he was uncomfortable with at least some death sentences. There was this question of maybe he could be pulled over to join the four liberals and say no more death penalty. But then Trump was elected, and of course we all know the story of how he got through three nominees, and that reshaped the court dramatically. And so now it is, at least to me, I mean, barring some really big ideological conversion among multiple conservatives on the court, it seems unlikely that the Supreme Court would take a big swing like that.
Well, it's a fascinating story how what I consider a horrible institution in this country has been at the very least diminished, and at least in practice we're getting close to being able to strangle it in the bathtub, as it were. Maurice Shama, the book is Let the Lord Sort Them, The Rise and the Fall of the Death Penalty. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate being here.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Hot bake.
Gonna take quick break, huh?
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, that just about does it for us. We are, of course, going to be talking more later in the program about the COVID relief bill. We are now in February. Joe Biden's been the president for 10 and a half days, I guess. Calendar days, not work days. But we shall see. Hopefully we'll get some reports as to what comes out of these talks he's having with the 10 Republicans. And of course, you know, it's going to be
hopefully nothing, by the way. Hopefully nothing.
I mean, I would like, you know, one of the arguments that you hear is, OK, have them pass whatever, $600 billion bill, an $800 billion bill. And do it through regular order, 60. It would be 60 to 40. You would see the bill passed. You would achieve that sort of filibuster threshold. And then the idea is then come back and do the rest through reconciliation. But as a political matter, you risk weakening the spine, as it were, or increasing the reluctance, however you want to frame this, of folks like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema and maybe even John Tester, because you have provided some relief. So the urgency is not there as much. And then on the other hand, you give the Republicans credit for something that, frankly, they don't deserve any credit for. You know, if you're going to, you know, if the Republicans...
And it's needed now. It's needed now. Like, the urgency is now, too, you know?
The urgency is now. And if you're going to... If you're going to say that you understand the urgent need of Americans, then suck it up and provide them more help than maybe you want to give them. I mean, it's just unbelievable that that's the way that it's phrased. But We will talk more about that as the days go on. If you missed any part of this show, you can check it out on the Peacock app on the Choice channel. We will see you tomorrow. For those of you who are sticking around, good for you.
Yeah, fun times.
Lots to talk about. I'm feeling a little better. Emma, I want to thank you for taking over the show on Friday.
No problem.
I had some weird, I'm not quite sure what it was, but I think they call it torticollis or something like that. It was, I had some type of pinched nerve in my head.
Oh, like, man.
I still have very little movement on my neck, but.
Did you see a doctor about it?
Well, I spoke to a doctor.
Okay.
Does this bring you any closer to a chiropractor visit, maybe?
No way. I got suggested one, and I was like, no way. I think I slept on it wrong, and I hadn't been sleeping well.
Why are you anti-chiropractor?
Your loss. Yeah, no, yeah. This is a series of debates.
I've heard incredible things from, like, a lot of friends about the what?
Chiropractic. I mean, chiropractic is a bit quackish on occasion. I mean, I would look up some lawsuits in England with Simon Singh. They sued him for questioning some of their methods. I think it's a little bit of placebo taken advantage of, and the lack of therapy you can get in our actual health systems. But I mean, some people have good results. So
yeah, but they crack your back, and it's like a euphoric.
Yeah, that's not good though. That's that can be bad. Actually,
I've never been, but I've had people crack my back for me, and it is incredible.
There is like loose cracking of backs, as opposed to like sort of someone who's in there really trying to manipulate. I you know, look, different strokes for different folks. For me, not going to do. Doctor gave me a little bit of prednisone, which I'm is scary medication as far as I'm concerned. But short term, it has really done wonders for me. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. We should say Jamie's not going to be joining us today. She's snowed in. She'll join us on Wednesday. In the meantime, Nomi's show is off today. Make sure you check it out. Tomorrow, I want to make it clear. I'm not disparaging chiropractors. I just don't like people touching me that much. And so that's basically it.
Okay. That adds up. Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about chiropracting, but when I did, yeah, I used to do Pilates at this place. And then,
oh, Pilates is great. I used to
do that. But they'd like at the end kind of stretch me out, and sometimes my back would crack. And I was like, this is the best thing I've ever experienced.
Yes. I mean, I just don't like to be I don't want to be manipulated in any way, fashion or otherwise.
Got it.
And all right. So so Nomi's show, she'll be back tomorrow. Obviously, check it out. The Noma Key Show at youtube.com. And check out the Antifada. They're Twitch streaming now, twitch.tv/theAntifada. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian media universe?
David and I did into the Left Reckoning with Jen Pan of the Jacobin Show last Thursday. Check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget to check out JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. These are movement buddies, folks, in Madison, Wisconsin. They also have great coffee. You can also find the Majority Report blend. So use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And don't forget the AM Quickie every morning, AM Quickie. All right, see you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a
and the alpha males are back.
I, I,
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner theme song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck your mind.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't not hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.